The following is a recording of the Robert Greenstein teleconference with the Center on Budget and Policy on Friday, May 31st, 2013 at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the line for questions. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Robert Greenstein. Mr. Greenstein, please begin.
This is Michelle Bazzi. I just wanted to let the participants know that we've changed how we're going to approach Q&A, and when it's the appropriate time after the presentation, all you'll need to do is to dial star 1, and you'll be added to the queue to ask questions. Thank you. Bob?
Thanks, and this will mean we no longer have to do some kind of alphabetical order from the beginning or the end of the alphabet and disadvantage people who happen to be at the wrong end of whichever alphabetical order we're using. As you know, we're focusing today on the release this morning of the annual report of the Social Security and Medicare trustees. As you probably all know, in neither case, Social Security or Medicare, were there dramatic big changes in this morning's report, but there were interesting things in both reports. And in just a moment, we're going to turn to Paul Vandewater and Kathy Rupping to go through the two reports. Paul, as many of you know, Paul is a senior fellow here at the Center. He served for many years as Assistant Director of the Congressional Budget Office. He also was Vice President for Health Policy at the National Academy of Social Insurance, where he oversaw projects on Medicare. And before that, he was also Associate Commissioner of the Social Security Administration for Research, Evaluation, and Statistics, and later Assistant Deputy Commissioner of SSA for Policy. Kathy Rupping and Paul will talk about the Medicare report. Kathy Rupping will talk about the Social Security report. Now a senior fellow here at the Center, Kathy spent 25 years at the Congressional Budget Office, where she covered a number of areas, including Social Security, and she's also spent some years at the Social Security Administration, the Department of Labor, and the National Academy of Sciences. As Paul will note, today's trustees report found that the date at which the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund will be exhausted moved back 2 years, from 2024 to 2026, and the shortfall is somewhat smaller than in last year's trustees report. In Social Security, the key numbers are very similar, in some cases identical, to those in last year's trustees report. As Kathy will discuss, the closest date, of course, is the scheduled expiration or exhaustion of the Social Security Disability Insurance Trust Fund in 2016. As Kathy will explain, however, disability insurance and Social Security retirement and survivors insurance are very closely intertwined, and it really is not possible to try to isolate DI and address its 2016 date on its own in isolation from the rest of Social Security unless one is willing to make very draconian changes that it is hard to believe the public or either party would accept. Social Security disability insurance really needs to be done in the context of overall Social Security solvency legislation. And hopefully that can be done by 2016. In the event that it cannot, policymakers can move funds from the Social Security Retirement Trust Fund to the Social Security Disability Trust Fund. It is a long-standing practice to shift funds among the Social Security Trust Funds when one is getting close to exhaustion and the other has more ample funding in it. It has been done a number of times in the past, and in fact, the headline to date today of Social Security reaching exhaustion of the trust funds in 2033, the 2033 date essentially assumes a reallocation from retirement to disability such that they would all hit the exhaustion date together in 2033. We're going to go first to Paul Vandewater, then to Kathy Rupping, and then to your questions. First, Paul Vandewater discussing the Medicare trust part of the trustees report.
Thanks, Bob. I'm going to make 5 points. All of these points plus other ones are covered in the statement which we will be about the trustees report, which will be issuing shortly, along with a statement on social security.
I should have it said at the front. Let's see, which is the one that's already
social security.
Our social security analysis in the form of a statement is already on our website. And the Medicare analysis that Paul has written will be up in 5 minutes. Will be up on our website.
First point, and I'll list the 5 points and then go through them in a bit more detail. The first point is, as Bob said, Medicare's financial outlook does indeed look a bit better than it did a year ago. But we need to keep in mind that the improvement is well within the usual year-to-year variation in the projections. Second, health reform, as we've said before, has significantly improved Medicare's financial outlook. Three, the projected insolvency of Medicare's hospital insurance trust fund doesn't mean that Medicare is going bankrupt or running out of money, as is sometimes suggested. Four, the new projections emphasize the importance of successfully implementing the cost control provisions of health reform. And fifth and finally, Medicare faces long-term financial challenges, but they are manageable without taking steps that would radically restructure the program. Now, as Bob said, in point number one, that Medicare's financial outlook does look better than it did a year ago. The insolvency date projected for Medicare's hospital insurance fund is now 2026, 2 years later than projected last year. And the hospital insurance's long-term shortfall is now down to 1.11% of taxable payroll as compared to 1.35% last year. I might note in passing that we emphasize the hospital insurance trust fund because Medicare's supplementary medical insurance trust fund, which covers physician payments, prescription drugs, and other healthcare service goods and services, is financed through premiums and general revenues and is always projected to be in financial balance. Second point to emphasize is that health reform has significantly improved Medicare's financial outlook. If we go back to 2009, which was the last trustees report issued prior to enactment of the Affordable Care Act, the trust fund exhaustion date was projected to be 2017, 9 years earlier than it's now projected to be. And a long-term shortfall in hospital insurance was projected to be 3.88% of payroll. And as I said a minute ago, the current shortfall is only 1.11% of payroll, a reduction of well more than 3.5 percentage points of GDP, very substantial. Third point, even though the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund is projected to go insolvent in 2026, that doesn't mean that the program is going bankrupt, as people sometimes say, or running out of money, as terminology is also sometimes used. Even in 2026, the year that's projected for exhaustion, incoming payroll taxes and other revenues to the HI Trust Fund will be sufficient to continue paying 87% of program costs. Moreover, it's important to note that trustees' reports have always projected impending insolvency for the hospital insurance trust fund. But nonetheless, Medicare has always paid the benefits owed because presidents and congresses have taken the steps necessary to keep spending and resources in balance in the near term. Fourth point, the new projections emphasize the importance of successfully implementing the cost control provisions of health reform. As you know, ever since the enactment of health reform, the trustees' reports have included not only projections showing the course of the trust funds under current law, but also an alternative projection assuming that there's some slippage in the enforcement of the or the efficacy of the cost control provisions of the ACA. The Medicare actuaries describe this as their illustrative alternative scenario. Using this alternative projection, there would be no difference in the projected date of HI insolvency, which would remain at 2020, but the 75-year shortfall in hospital insurance would be almost twice as great, 2.17% of payroll. Nonetheless, it has to be remembered that prior to health reform, the shortfall was 3.88% of payroll, still much, much larger than you would have, even if there is some slippage in the ACA's cost control provisions. And fifth and finally, as these numbers indicate, Medicare does still face long-term financial challenges, but especially with the improvements over the past several years, those challenges are manageable without needing to radically restructure the Medicare program. In the near term, we can and should generate some additional savings to help strengthen Medicare and provide additional deficit reduction while providing while preserving Medicare's guarantee of health coverage. The measures proposed in the president's budget, including ending Medicare's overpayments to drug companies for drugs for low-income beneficiaries, increasing funding for activities to prevent and detect fraud and waste and abuse, restructuring Medicare cost sharing and Medigap supplemental insurance, and raising premiums for well-off beneficiaries. All of those are steps that, that could be taken that would make further improvement in Medicare's financial status. The key fiscal policy goal in over the next 10 years, as we've written, should be to stabilize the federal debt relative to the size of the economy. The Congressional Budget Office's latest projections indicate that that task, because of the improvements in the economy and improvements in the projections of Medicare and Medicaid and other health program spending, suggest that that can be done a bit more easily than we had thought not too many months ago. With that, I'll end and pass the baton to Kathy.
Thank you, Bob and Paul. I'm pleased to join you today to talk about the Social Security Trustees report that was released this morning. And in my brief discussion, I'm going to make four major points. The first one is the report contains no surprises. There are very few changes from last year. The second point is that disability insurance does need to be addressed because the program technically will become insolvent in 2016, but we have some very specific suggestions for how policymakers should address that. The third point is that Social Security has weathered the economic downturn. And the fourth point is that policymakers need to address the overall solvency of Social Security, and the sooner they do that, the better. But as they tackle that issue, they need to keep in mind the importance of Social Security and the strong public support for the program. So returning to my first point, the Social Security Trustees report released today showed very little change from last year's projections. The trustees continue to estimate that the combined Social Security trust funds will become exhausted in 2033. Again, that does not indicate that the program will end at that time. It simply means that if policymakers don't intervene, that the program would then be able to pay benefits only to the extent they are supported by incoming taxes. Now, at that point, if no actions are taken, Social Security could continue to pay three-quarters of promised benefits, and that would continue to be true for the remainder of the 75-year projection period. The headline number, which is the shortfall as expressed as a percentage of the taxable payroll, has inched up very slightly from last year, from 2.67% of payroll to 2.72%. However, that entire apparent deterioration is essentially cosmetic. It results only from adding one more year, 2087, to projections that formerly ended in 2086 and does not represent any fundamental change in the outlook. My second point has to do with disability insurance. As I mentioned, the combined Social Security trust funds are expected to be depleted in 2033. But yet the two trust funds, the very large Old Age and Survivors Fund, which pays for benefits to retirees and widows and to young children who have lost a breadwinner parent, and the much smaller Disability Insurance Trust Fund, are legally separate. And the Disability Insurance Trust Fund on its own faces depletion in 2016. At that point, if Congress doesn't intervene, it would only be able to pay 80% of promised benefits. We have consistently pointed out in analyses that are linked in our statements that the depletion of the DI Trust Fund was foreseen. In fact, Congress projected at the last time it reallocated tax rates in 1995 that the DI Trust Fund would become exhausted in, sure enough, 2016. It was well known that the program was entering a period at which it would face its peak demographic pressures from the aging of the baby boom into its late 50s and early 60s. Those pressures will subside, but they won't subside soon enough and far enough to avert DI depletion. We believe very strongly that DI is inextricably intertwined with the Social Security Retirement Program. It has very similar eligibility criteria. It uses the same benefit formula. It has the same tax base. 70% of DI beneficiaries are over 50, and 30% are over 60. In other words, you cannot intelligently address the programs separately. You need to tackle them together. If Congress is not able to do that in time to avert DI depletion in 2016, the sensible thing to do is simply to reallocate the tax rates between the programs. That is a well-accepted and traditional way of addressing a shortfall in one program or the other that the Congress has done on 11 occasions in the past and should consider again. Our third point is that Social Security has weathered the economic downturn. It has suffered some bruises along the way, but it has survived intact and in good shape for the next two decades. It is correct that the annual revenues of Social Security have slipped below the annual benefit payments. That was always expected to happen later this decade. But the date at which that happened did move up. It occurred in 2010, and that, of course, was due to the very severe economic downturn. That is not a problem for the program or its beneficiaries, because the program still has a $2.7 trillion trust fund, and interest income is and will continue to be a significant source of income to Social Security that has helped it weather the economic downturn, and the demographic pressures to come. In response to the economic downturn, Congress also enacted a two-year partial payroll tax holiday, which in 2011 and 2012 temporarily suspended 2 percentage points of the payroll tax that workers owed. That did not harm the Social Security Trust Fund, because it compensated them through a general revenue transfer. But finally, my last point, the importance of overall Social Security solvency. As we said, the program is in sound shape for two decades. It faces depletion around 2033, but that does not mean that Congress should wait two decades to address the financing problems of Social Security. addressing it sooner rather than later would allow Congress to spread whatever changes are necessary fairly across generations and cohorts of workers. And most importantly, it would allow both workers and retirees to plan their futures with confidence. But having said that, we have always said that a fair and balanced solvency package should include a significant revenue component. Social Security benefits are extremely modest, both in dollar terms. The average benefit for a retiree or a widow is only about $15,000. For disabled workers, it's even lower. And benefits are extremely modest by international standards, putting the United States fairly near the bottom when ranked against other developed nations. Furthermore, polls consistently show that people of all ages and all income levels do support Social Security and are willing to pay higher taxes to preserve it as a vital part of the safety net. So we continue to believe that higher revenues should be a major component of any solvency package, and that can come from raising the taxable maximum, from broadening the tax base to include things like flexible spending accounts and cafeteria plans, and from raising the tax rate very modestly. Again, we say more about those options in our statement. So having said that, I will wrap up and turn this back over to Michelle.